Good morning and welcome to the December 16th, 2019 meeting of the Chelan County PUD. I'd like to thank everyone for coming and to remind you to please silence any electronic devices that you may have brought with you this morning. Good opportunity for me to do the same. Today's meeting is both a study and a business session, with the study session starting this morning at 10 o'clock and the afternoon business session starting at 1. We welcome the public's input at all of our meetings and remind you that our meetings are recorded, that if you wish to address any item on the agenda, we please ask that you step to the forward to the microphone across from me, and please state your name, your address for the record, and please limit your comments to 3 minutes. In the event that there's additional comments that with new information that you would wish to make, as soon as everyone has had their opportunity to make their first comments, we'll invite you back to the mic for a second time for new information. Today, we have two commissioners present, Commissioners Congdon and Commissioners McKenna. And I didn't hear, was Dennis on the phone this morning?
I didn't hear Commissioner Bowles.
Expecting him this afternoon.
He's on the phone. So Commissioner Bowles will be on the phone this afternoon. We also have General Manager Steve Wright, General Counsel Eric Walquist, and Rebecca Garfin, Clerk of the Board, with us today. We have Cassie, who's here today. Cassie, would you please lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance in a safety minute?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Good morning. As mentioned, my name is Cassandra Bertelson. I'm with the Internal Audit Department here at the PUD. I've been here for about 2.5 years, so thank you for having me this morning. I'm here to prevent just a few holiday safety tips. So to jump in a little bit about electrical cords and lights. So we all have surge protectors at home and power strips. So these items are great because they provide extra outlets, but be sure that you remember things like lights and phones and computers are usually pretty okay, but you never want to plug in items such as toasters, crock pots, especially space heaters, so that can overload the circuits. Make sure that you don't ever connect multiple power strips. I don't know that most people know that's called daisy chaining, and that can also be a potential hazard as well. If a power strip or surge protector feels hot, that's usually a pretty good sign that it's overloaded and that you should probably unplug a few things or plug it into the wall if you need to. Also, be sure to watch for burn marks, melted plastic, those type of things. Never a good sign. When you're hanging up lights and cords and stuff outdoors, make sure that they're outdoor rated and not necessarily indoor as well. Make sure that you're not using tacks and nails to hang up those outdoor lights. You don't want to puncture those wires and get zapped during this time of year. Make sure that you're checking the tree lights. Even if you've just purchased them, make sure there's no, you know, frayed wire stuff. You don't want any fire hazards from those as well. Couple things with regards to fireplace safety. Before lighting any sort of fires, make sure that you remove greens, boughs, papers, other decorations from the fireplace area. Check to make sure that your flue is open as well. And then make sure that you don't actually burn any sort of wrapping papers in your fireplace if you've got that capability. I remember growing up and having grandparents and aunts and uncles just kind of ball up those wads of, you know, wrapping paper. You've got it all sitting around your living room and tossing it in. And before you know it, it's a pretty big ball of fire. So be safe when you're doing that at home. Also, when it comes to decorations and toy safety, if you've got small children running around the area, make sure that you're avoiding any sort of trimmings that resemble candy or food that may tempt children. I was just hearing a story from my sister this weekend about her little 2-year-old who proceeded to remove all the candy canes off their tree and took them to her bedroom and had quite the snack. So make sure you keep those out of reach for the little ones. Make sure that they aren't playing with toys that are plugged into the wall as well for electrical safety. They obviously have toys and stuff that are more appropriate that use batteries and have screws and stuff to make sure that those are safe. And then anything for children under the age of 3, they use kind of the toilet paper tube recommendation. If you can stuff any piece of a toy down that tube, chances are they could potentially choke on it. So just make sure that anything smaller than that, you're keeping out of reach. So with that, have a happy and safe holiday season.
Well, really good recommendation.
Yeah, timing, very well timed.
And it made me recall one item that you mentioned, that if you forget it once, you'll never forget it again. and that's opening the flue on the fireplace. once is all it takes.
Exactly. Learn the hard way. It takes to do it, but sometimes it happens.
That's right. Cassie, thank you.
Thank you.
So we have an agenda in front of us, and any item is subject to transfer. Do I hear any such request?
I would, based on management's recommendation, would like to suggest that we move items 12, 13, and 14 to the consent agenda.
Do we have a second?
We have a second.
It's been moved and seconded. Thank you. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Fellow commissioners, you need to unmute your phones.
Thank you. It's been moved, seconded, and it is now carried. So, Steve, would you be kind enough to please introduce the CPO winners?
I would like to do that. I'd like to ask Loretta and Todd to come forward if they would, please, and just have a join us up at the table. These are ones that I'm really very excited about, and I because they not only are great examples of cycle of personal ownership, they also fit with some pretty big district initiatives, which the board is familiar with and knows that we are working on. So Loretta has been focused on the new customer information system that we're putting together. And we're in that moment when it's really tough, to be honest. So it's close to go live. We're hoping that January will be the go live date that we're able to actually put this out there so that customers will see the impacts. And that's a stressful time. And there's a whole bunch of things that have to get done here to make sure that, in fact, we can balance. And balance means that we're producing the same amount of revenue with the new system as we were under the old system. And I got some really fabulous news last week that, in fact, we were down to $33 and a miss, something like that.
$39.77.
Okay, I got to be really clear about that, what that is. Which, you know, on our revenue stream is really pretty extraordinary to be that close. And it takes tremendous attention to detail and focus and really wanting it to be good. And so I thought when I heard that Loretta was really a cornerstone of that that work, that and in fact the entire senior team believed that this was really a great example of cycle of personal ownership, taking personal accountability, making sure we've got something that works. And so wanted to congratulate her. And wanted to say for a moment about Todd, I actually was in the meeting when the thing that he did that initiated what led to this moment. We've been working on technology roadmaps for quite a while. So we've done a lot of work internally. We decided that it would be a good idea to bring in an external consultant who had worked on technology roadmaps at a bunch of other similar utilities to help us just, you know, do we have blinders on? Are we missing things? Do we understand this well enough? And there are a lot of technology roadmaps here, and there are a lot of people working on them. And what Todd did in that moment was step up and say, boy, there's a lot going on here. Somebody needs to coordinate all this activity, the relationship between the consultant and all of these work groups, and make sure that this is pulled together in a way that we'll have internal alignment and we won't just create an organizational mess. It was really a powerful moment. I remember thinking, wow, that was pretty cool that he stepped up and did that. Not only did he do that, he carried through and got it done. So again, both the customer information system and the technology roadmaps, very important initiatives for us, following through on board guidance. And here you have a couple of folks that have really stepped up to make sure that we're going to be successful at pulling that off. So we wanted to say thank you to them today. And I believe they're aware that they have the opportunity to say something to the board if they would like to, no requirement to do so. But if you'd like to offer anything, this would be the moment to do so.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity. I've been here 4 years now, so I meet somebody new, it feels like, every day. And so it's a great opportunity to meet even more people and just learn more about the great expertise that's here. And, you know, what a great job everybody does with positive attitudes and working together. So it's a wonderful place to work, and I appreciate that opportunity, Steve. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. You know, I think what you both do is one of the things among many, but one that's very important that keeps me awake at night, knowing that these are very critical roles and that it's so easy that if you don't have that focus on detail, that it might just get slipped under the carpet. So I am really, really pleased to meet both of you and to be assured that I don't have to miss any sleep tonight. So thank you very much for being here. Thank you for what you do.
Yeah, thank you. Everybody have a happy holidays. Yeah.
Thank you. You too. Thanks.
If I could just take a second, I want to give them their coin.
Okay.
Well, onto the regular agenda?
Yes, please.
Okay. So we want to start with a follow-up conversation regarding advanced metering infrastructure and the opt-out policy that would go with that. We've attempted to take the feedback that the board provided us at the last meeting and translate that into policy. And we've done some additional research as well, talking to other utilities based on questions that we heard from the board. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Lindsay Mons to provide a presentation for you.
Good morning, Commissioners. Lindsay Mons, Business Manager in Customer Utilities. Steve kind of stole my introduction. Today is a continuation of our conversation from a couple weeks ago when we introduced our opt-out policy ideas. We have talked with others, talked with our vendor, our Anixter iTron representatives there to get a better understanding of what things are going to look like for us going forward. So we'll talk about that and other things. So based on our information obtained from Anixter, we're actually going to get a different type of meter, or not type, but a different meter than some of our other utilities who have gone the same direction. So it hasn't been as easy as just calling up someone else who's used the iTron meter to find out how they're doing it. Because as technology continues to advance, things, you know, in the meters change. And so the meters that we're getting are slightly different from those that others are getting. From our discussions with Anixter and iTron, this is our understanding currently of how our opt-out exchange program would work. So those meters, when a customer chooses to opt out, we would have the ability to either remotely or on-site deactivate the communications within an AMI communications enabled meter, which was at our last meeting our preferred option to just utilize the one type of meter. And that's all great at the initial opt-out point. It's when we get to the end of an opt-out period, say a customer moves out or chooses to no longer participate in the opt-out program, that things get much more complicated. So when a customer moves out and we need to convert that meter back to our standard metering approach, we would actually have to go out and replace the meter with a new AMI meter and remove the old one. It's because those communications boards cannot be reactivated in the field. They actually have to be sent back to the vendor, we found. It's a proprietary process that they have, so they all have to be reprogrammed. We're anticipating there would be a fee for that, but because this is a new technology that they're bringing on, we don't know what that would look like exactly. But we do know that this probably is not in alignment with the guidance that we heard at the last meeting from the board, which was to have some cost-effective options for both our customers and the district associated with the opt-out program. So because of this, we did start looking at what our other meter options might be. We've identified three different options. The first option here being continuing with the standard meter, the iTron meter that we're utilizing for all of our other customers, but purchasing those without the communicating board altogether. So we would be stocking two different meters in this case, one with the communications and one without. And we would still exchange those meters when a customer opted out, but it would have the standard look and feel about it. Those meters would also be able to collect data, both for the customer benefit and for our system monitoring. So we could provide some basic, albeit delayed, information to the customers about their usage. The second option would be a non-communicating digital meter. So these are solid-state meters, similar to things that we have in the field, but they don't have a communications within them. And then the third option would be utilizing analog or electromechanical meters, which are kind of the old original style meters that we do still have in the field as well. There are pros and cons of all these options, of course. The first several lines on this chart here are associated with the data and the data collection through meter reading and whatnot. With the communications board removed, our standard meter, like I mentioned, would continue to collect data. That data would have to be integrated into our system. So there is some additional time on our side for things like that. However, it does give us the capability of continuing with the quarterly meter read approach, which is our preferred option. The other two meters, both the non-communicating digital meter and the analog meter, would most likely need to be read more frequently because we don't have that information on usage. That, of course, creates some additional cost on a monthly basis. But it does save some cost because we're not then coming back and integrating that data into our system. So, you know, some balance there. As far as initial cost goes, down towards the bottom of the table, options one and two would be new meters that we would purchase, whereas option three, we would have to reuse the existing meters that we have. The electromechanical or analog meters are no longer manufactured new from meter vendors, so we would have to maintain the meters that we have, continue testing them, and keeping them in operating service. Yes.
Lindsay, on the analog meters, are we able to rebuild them and refurbish them?
How much of that we do, I'm not entirely familiar with, but I know we do go out in the field and make adjustments to those meters. So we test them in the field and then adjust various things within them to make them read in line with what we would expect. As far as entirely rebuilding meters, I'm looking at Ray over Rebecca's shoulder for a head nod. But, I'll address that real quick. Do you want to come up to the microphone, Ray?
Thank you.
And Ray, if you would identify yourself and your job too.
Okay, Ray Potter, journeyman meterman in our meter shop. Basically, to rebuild an electrical mechanical, it's not really worth it. The cost is so low on them. It's really more effective to test it. If it's slightly out of adjustment, we can make some minor adjustments. But if it's a long ways out of adjustment, it's easier to just dispose of it and get a new one.
Okay, thank you. I'm envisioning a day when far into the future that we might run out of surplus used.
That's a great question. We've kind of debated that already. You know, what are we going to have for opt-out customers versus what are we going to take out of the field in the exchange? How many do we stock and warehouse? That's all questions that will have to be answered.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, thank you very much, Ray. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Ray. So because we are pulling those meters out of the field and not purchasing them new, there is a lower initial cost for that meter. But there is, however, a higher ongoing cost because we will have to be doing that testing at least on an annual basis and the adjustments to those meters. We do also have challenges with the analog meters as far as billing accuracy goes, which does create cost as well. They do slow down over time and they do occasionally just shut off and then shut back on. So, and we don't know that they've done that, but it is something that we've experienced. So in all cases, all of these meters with an opt-out program would require the PUD have access to the meter. So exterior access, property access, all of those things. So I did touch a little bit on cost on the slides, and we talked extensively about it at the last meeting. So I just wanted to walk through what I think that I heard from the board and collect additional information from you. This is a conversation that we've been having, and I'm sure that you've put some thought into it since our last meeting. But last time around, so one-time fees, these are the initial fees associated with becoming an opt-out customer. These are things like installing the new meter, paying in advance for the change out of the meter at the completion of the program, and any administrative costs associated with it. During our last board meeting, The board seemed to generally be in favor of establishing a $0 opt-out initial fee and continuing to study the cost of these fees. As we talked last time, we don't actually know exactly how much this is going to cost because we've not done it yet. These would be anything that we would put in place now would be an estimate. So continuing to look at these fees, tracking and gaining that experience before we establish, if we establish an upfront fee associated with an opt-out program. The boxes at the bottom are what we anticipate the cost to be. As we discussed last time, many utilities have fees associated with one-time initial fees that are not necessarily fully recovering their cost. So this is where the board has the opportunity to set those fees as you feel most appropriate. The other fee associated with an opt-out program is a monthly fee. So this is things like meter reading, data integration, meter testing for those analog meters. At the last board meeting, we heard somewhere around $50 a month seemed appropriate. This would be about our average cost for a meter option one or two that are either that standard meter without the communications board or a solid state digital non-communicating meter. With the analog meter, however, we do see probably an additional $15 to $30 a month associated with that specific program because of the testing that would be required of those meters. We heard the board in favor of a low-income senior disabled discount. So our existing programs, those customers that are eligible for our existing programs would also be eligible for a discount in this case, 50% on that monthly charge. We would again continue to study the cost of these various activities on an ongoing basis, like we do with all of our other fees and charges, to make sure that our cost recovery is in line with our actuals. So I'm going to pause there to see if you have any questions before I kind of shift gears here in the presentation.
Let me do one thing. I want to try to summarize the question that I think we're putting in and offer a low-income senior disabled discount. And so we're just reflecting back what we think we heard and checking in and making sure we got that right. Second, we had not intended to offer an analog meter option, but given that we are unable to make the remote connect and disconnect of the communication frequency, we're just saying that's an option for you to consider. It's a costly option, as you can see. And so if the board was interested in that, then we would say, well, then there would be probably be a cost in addition to the $50 a month for that to create that option, somewhere in that $15 to $30 range per month. The first half of the question is, did we hear you right on zero, 50, and a low-income senior discount? And the second part of the question is just thinking about whether we should have analog option, and if so, should we charge for that option? And we don't need your answer necessarily right now, because certainly we'd make this whole thing available for public comment. You may want to hear that. But if you have comments for us now, we're also happy to hear those.
Commissioners, any comments, any feedback that we can provide to Steve?
Well, I'll start while Steve and Ann are gathering their thoughts, if they have any. I think you heard me correctly. This responds very well. My sense is, I'm looking at your slide there in the last little box, assuming 100 participants, I'm assuming we have checked, I know we've checked with other utilities, and that might actually be a high number for our utility that opt in. And so the numbers that we're talking about are quite small in terms of people that may opt in. And so that being said, the actual cost of adding the quote analog option is not a big number that we probably need to be terribly concerned with. Well, my thinking of simplicity, if a person opts out and wants to keep the meter they've got, and somebody else gets a new disabled meter, why should that cost be different from a management standpoint? But so that's my thought. There was another one in the slide previous to that that I want to make sure I provide my thoughts on. A future meter exchange from whatever the opt-out is to the standard. If it's, I think you'd have two scenarios there. One, if a person who had opted out wanted to get back in, that would be a fee-based structure. But if the home sold or the apartment, or I guess it would be the home sold, and the new owner wished to be part of the AMI, I don't think there should be a charge to that individual for when there's been an ownership change.
Yes, that is correct. We would not want to put any sort of hurdles in place to have people participate in our AMI program. This would actually be a fee on the opt-out customer to convert that meter back to our standard when they were done. So
right.
The fee is actually on
right.
on the opt-out side and
right.
not the comeback
yeah.
side. Good. And I'll also address your comment on the analog meter testing. So a big portion of that cost is actually associated with the equipment that we need to purchase to do that in-field testing of those meters. We've not been doing a whole lot of that lately because we've been moving towards the AMI program, and also we've been exchanging those meters for our standard drive-by meters. So that testing equipment would need to be purchased, which is a fixed cost. So that does not change based on the number of customers. And actually, we would see if we had even fewer customers select an analog option, that cost would actually increase on mm-hmm. a customer basis.
And Steve, any comments?
Hello? Hi, this is Ann.
Yes, Ann.
Are you there?
Yes.
So a couple things. The senior and disabled discount, I'm happy to see that you've moved it to 50% from 20%. I'd still rather it be zero, but I can live with 50%, I think. And I was a little confused by Randy's comments, but I'll talk with Randy later. He was talking about opt-in and then about opt-out. So I'm not sure. I don't know, maybe Randy clarified just so people aren't confused on that. And I support no initial upfront fee. I do know there are ongoing monthly charges that work. We will need to charge. I'd like to keep those as low as possible. We'll negotiate. We'll work on that later. Thanks.
I'll give you my feedback. I think you've heard my comments correctly in terms of $50 and no upfront fee, and I am in support of the senior and low income and disabled mm-hmm. discount. Now, in terms of a question, as we look at the additional meter options, it appears to me, and I'm looking at your chart, the colored highlighted chart, that one there, thank you.
Yeah.
And where the category says other than monthly reads acceptable, I'm assuming that means that in number one, you have the ability to do that quarterly. And number three, you do not, which means you'd have to do it monthly, which increases your cost. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's one additional cost. Now, if you look at accuracy for billing, number one, highly accurate, so you can bank on the numbers that are going to be correct. Number three, no. So there's some variance. As we look at manual data incorporation for district and customer use, that may or may not have a dollar value. But where I begin to see is initial cost, impact to ongoing cost. Those two areas indicate to me that utilizing number three is going to carry a higher cost. So the question I would have is, if we were going to make the option a lower cost option available, for example, if the $50 a month opt-out was for a new standard meter without communications board. And that represented the cost for that implementation. But a customer said, no, I didn't want that. I want to have an analog. So we allow them to have an option. Mm-hmm. And that analog option is going to have to carry a heavier cost. So perhaps instead of $50, that should be a larger number that represents the actual cost associated with allowing that as an option. And I don't know how cumbersome this might be or create difficulty for the district. So I'm throwing this out as both a statement and a question. If we were to offer something like that, does it just become too cumbersome for the district?
To provide two options.
Well, essentially you'd have three. You'd have a fully functioning digital meter that would be a two-way. Standard meter with only no communications mm-hmm. board. And then number three, you'd have an analog. So you'd have three choices. Is that getting too confusing?
No, I think we could have, our standard metering, which would be the majority of our customers, and then the two different opt-out options. Am I hearing you correctly?
Right. Yeah. So essentially, you might have someone who embraces the concept of, okay, I'll go with a digital meter. You're telling me you're going to take out the communication board. I believe you. It's going to cost me less. I like that idea. And then you're going to have maybe somebody else who says, no, I don't believe you. I want the old analog meter. I don't care. I'll pay more because it represents a higher cost for the district. That cost then should be passed on. And that's sort of where my mind is going with this.
Yep. We could do that, certainly.
Yep, we're following exactly along with you and thinking that that's the best way to make sure that you have cost follow cost causation. General principle for rate making.
Yeah. Okay. I just didn't want to create something so complex that it ended up costing us more in the end.
So I think we're comfortable that it will be more cumbersome, no question about it, but it sends the right price signal.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So this is Steve McKenna. I appreciate that last round of questions and answers from Gary and staff. That answers my questions, and I don't have any additional questions at this time.
You actually impacted my thought process, too, so thank you, Gary.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Any public here today that want to chime in on that? No? No? No public today, so all right.
So I did want to also today take a minute to review the eligibility information. We talked about this briefly at the last meeting, but we focused so much on cost, which, of course, we did again today. But just as a reminder for the board and any public that might listen to the presentation, with our opt-out program eligibility requirements, this would be something available only to our residential customers because of the type of metering, typically a commercial different usage patterns, different type of metering, different needs. So residential services, and we could do this for multifamily up to four units. Again, that's where we start to see the different metering come into play. They would require landlord permission, however, and then single phase services. So that's kind of the first hurdle that a customer would need to overcome in our opt-out program. They would also not be able to be a net metered customer. So net metered customers are those of ours who, say, have a solar panel or some other type of generating equipment where they utilize power from that when it's operating and then utilize power from our system in the other times. And the power flows both ways in those situations. So this would not be available for those net metered customers. Any customers on this program would also have to have a satisfactory and timely payment history. No unpaid account balances. So one of the benefits associated with the AMI system going forward is our ability to kind of secure our revenue stream. Plus, with this program having a quarterly meter reads and things, it just puts us in a riskier situation when we have customers that don't have that adequate payment history. As I mentioned, any sort of opt-out requests would require property owner permission. particularly if those customers are renting. All customers would need to be currently and in the past in compliance with our utility service regulations. So this touches a bit on the adequate payment history, but it also covers things like customers reporting, say, their cryptocurrency or HDL usage. So in the past, we've had trouble in that area associated with noncompliance with regulations. So any customer in a situation like that would not be eligible for these programs. And then the meter must also be physically accessible to staff, so in the open, able to access the property when we need to, things like that. And then just some of the customer service impacts associated with an opt-out program for awareness of those customers. They will not be able to receive the enhanced benefits of an AMI system, so our new standard of service there. Things like near real-time usage data, energy alerts, premises-specific outage information would obviously not be available because we would not have that real-time information from our system. In the future, if we develop programs in the conservation area or in other areas that might rely on that data from the advanced metering system, these customers may not be eligible for those programs. Inherently... when we're doing quarterly or less than monthly reads and estimating bills in the interim, we get some variability that's unexpected. So if we have a cold snap, all of a sudden bills might get high, but you might not see it if it's your estimated month. And then when your actuals come in that month, maybe or that quarter might be significantly higher than anticipated. And then as we've discussed, all of our ongoing meter reading and associated fees would apply for these opt-out customers. So I just wanted to make sure the board had awareness of all that. And if there were any concerns or things that we needed to look further into, that you had an opportunity before we draft up official policy to provide feedback there as well.
Commissioners, any comments? For Lindsay?
I think you're going the right direction.
Thank you.
Good. I agree.
Well, it's been a team effort. It's not just me. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you, Lindsay.
You're welcome. So we'll continue working on this, drafting up information for you. All of these policies are, of course, board adopted via resolution. So we'll be back again.
Go from there. I'm going to take a moment and just try to summarize where I think we are, too, because I'm anxious to move this forward to a final resolution and a decision by the board. And as we've said before, this is really a board decision. We're taking guidance from you on this. Number one, what we will do is we will keep the record open for public comment until at least a week before the next board meeting so that we have a chance to incorporate any comment. That would put it out through that week that has New Year's in it. And we'll, if we get any written comment, we will share that with the board as soon as we get it. Second, we'll be moving forward with a zero administrative cost, $50 monthly fee option. And we will draft an option for an analog meter with an additional cost per month associated with that for the board to consider. And we'll actually come prepared to go one of two ways, either to include that option or not. And of course, the board can also find a middle ground in between those if it wants to. But we'll bring you something that at least creates that option that you can consider. Does that sound acceptable to the board?
Yes.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Good. Thank you.
Okay. Good. That's what we needed. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Lindsay. Good job.
Okay. Next up, we wanted to give you a facilities update, particularly the service center, and an update on the design activities that have been going on. Dan Frazier, David Lodge will be presenting.
Morning, Commissioners. Dan Frazier, Director of Shared Services.
David Lodge, project manager with engineering and project management.
So this is a great project, obviously, we've been working on for a while, and this is a good opportunity for us to come and update the board. We're at a kind of critical juncture in the design process. We're getting near the end of schematic design and into design development. So today we'll be taking you through kind of the design activities that we've been involved in. So we've called this our evolution of design or journey of discovery. There's a lot of things that happen during a project of this magnitude. New things we learn, things that we look back on and say, well, we may have gotten that one a little off, but now we know going forward what we need to do. And then how we've accommodated this journey of discovery. We'll get into some potential solutions. We want to make sure you understand the outstanding project risks and then give you a little bit on the project timeline and our recommendation going forward.
So as Dan mentioned, we're wrapping up schematic design, and this has been a great process where we've engaged a lot of different program teams and stakeholders and really tried to think about how the district is going to be working in the future and try to understand the spaces that we need. We're also working with the customer owner team on looking at our public spaces and how we can best serve our customers, owners, and represent the communities we serve. As we begin to move into design development, this is where we start adding detail, and it's important that we lock down the space from schematic design so we can move forward. We're also working with our GCCM partner, Absher Construction, and they're providing tremendous value in cost estimating and value engineering and looking at constructability of the different systems in the building.
What does that term mean?
Constructability? How best to put all the pieces together in construction. So an example of this is we brought a team together, different trades, to look at the building envelope and how we would create trade flow and how we would put all of the pieces of the envelope together in the most efficient manner. And that informs the architect's design so they can incorporate that in from the beginning. A lot of times that's just figured out in the job trailer on site, but we have the ability to figure it out now and get it built into the design.
And this is actually one of the benefits of GCCM that we knew early on would be a benefit to this magnitude of a project. And we're going to be back in January to talk to the commission about, you know, what we anticipated GCCM helping us. And now that we've got a bit under our belt between Rock Island, Rocky Reach, and this project, kind of what we're finding. And so this is one of the great pieces that we were able to inform the design by having our contractor tell us the way you're thinking about doing it probably doesn't work, but this way would be better. And that's the constructability. Very important piece.
So as we progress through design, it's been a real learning process. So like I mentioned, we're trying to think about how we're going to operate in the future and take all the things that we're doing really well and have worked for us for a long time and implementing those and trying to improve on all the things that we can get better at. So now we're getting into a lot more detail. We're programming each space and trying to maximize efficiency. And we're understanding a lot more demands on the space needs. And so just some examples of those are creating lab space for our technology groups for research and development. Thinking about the work that our daytime dispatch group is going to have in the future and how to accommodate those needs. Building in space for our technology and telecom infrastructure for the long term, and then creating space for our drawing and document vaults, and also building in space for program team or project teams as new initiatives arise. So all of these are creating more demand than the number showed in the initial program. And then additionally, we have experienced some staff growth compared to our initial program. So the growth over the last few years has exceeded what the project anticipated for future growth. And working with all of our stakeholder groups, we've identified the possibility of additional growth in the coming years. And so we're trying to accommodate approximately 70 additional staff from what we initially planned on the campus.
I could take a second to describe what is meant by growth there. Some of this is just a better understanding. So we used FTE versus petition. Versus positions, and so you've got in some cases more spaces needed just to cover the same number of FTE. Commissioners are a good example of that. You're not here all the time, but space is needed for you to have offices. So getting the in-depth understanding about each particular position and the space that's required for it was a portion of this. And then in addition to that, we have increased the size of staff since we initiated this project.
Thank you for the clarification. So we've responded by implementing a number of different strategies. We've taken areas that were identified for future growth and utilized those in the initial design. We've reduced the workstation sizes from what we originally set out, and we've reduced some of the common spaces and collaborative areas to accommodate people and more customized space needs. We've also reduced some of the crew rooms, the boardroom, the lobby, the cafeteria, and we've taken some work groups and moved them out of the administration building and into the operations buildings, which actually provides better efficiencies for those groups, the CM technicians and Fish and Wildlife. So as a result, like I said, we've reduced some of the meeting and collaborative spaces. We've eliminated some of our areas for future potential growth. So we've already, you could say we picked some of the low-hanging fruit already. And as we tightly program and tailor the space, it provides limited flexibility and resiliency for future needs, for future changes. It's also had an impact on our budget contingency, and we've seen some reduction in that, which may not be adequate if future risks are fully realized. And then it's reduced the square foot per employee allocation. So in the end, we do have a program that meets our needs at move-in. We do have some strategies for accommodating future growth, but it puts us in more of a reactive position, where accommodating future administrative growth would mean further reducing either workstation sizes or reducing shared collaborative space.
So let me take you through the numbers. And some numbers shared. So currently in the headquarters and on the campus, the administrative space is allocated at about 262 square feet per person. This doesn't include crew spaces. It's the administrative functions. When we looked at what the Washington State Department of Enterprise Services has a space allocation standard. Now, our project doesn't really fit perfectly into that, but it's the best standard we have available. Using their standard and including the pieces that we're including in our facility, their standard is about 196 square feet per person. And so that's kind of the standard for administrative buildings. We're currently at about 186 square feet per person on our move-in date. So we would move in slightly below the state standard. So that's what caused us to say, what would it take to get kind of closer back to the state standard and allow us some potential for future growth and some flexibility in the building. And so what we're looking at doing is adding one structural bay basically to the building. And that's about 10,000 square feet, or roughly 10,000 square feet. And so what that would do, it would take us to about 210 square feet per person, and it would allow for 7% growth in the administrative function over a period of time, whatever that time was, 10, 15 years, before we'd be back at the state standard. So it allows us to grow and not be below that state standard, you know, right when we walk in the door. So that's kind of the what the recommendation is to get us back to where we anticipated being when we did our early programming in the project. So what does this kind of change cost? Well, we looked at it a couple ways. So as David said, we move in, we're okay when we get there, but we'll have a future need. And so we compared what it would cost to add this approximately 10,000 square feet to the building now versus doing something later. So we looked at the first line there is do it during design, which is where we are right now. About $5 to $6 million at this point is our estimated cost, fully loaded with contingencies and everything associated with it. To do this in 2026, so a couple years after we move in, have a little bit of growth. Now, would we build a 10,000 square foot building? Probably not. We would try to accommodate it some other way, because that's a lot. There's a lot of burden on a discrete project, and to do something small like 10,000 square feet comes with a lot of burden, and that's why the numbers bear out where they do. To do that, there's all the other costs that this project is carrying already in there, all the site development costs and all those things. So it'll be about 10.8 to 11.6 million. To do that, and that's kind of the variation is where construction inflation happens during that period. And then if we waited until 2029, it would just continue to get more expensive. So our gut feeling when we started this was there's probably never a better time to do this than with initial construction, because it's an order of magnitude and it's all those carrying costs that this project's already carrying. So there's an economy of scale when you add a small bit to a bigger project versus doing a small project on its own. So that's kind of the cost comparison, but doing it now versus doing it later. So
As we always do, we have to look at the business case that got us to this decision initially. And so we look back and what would this new understanding of where we're at, what kind of effect would that have on the, what were the three finalists in the evaluation during the decision in April? And those two other options were the status quo and the 10-year split option. As we understood in April, this campus was already very stressed to fit the PUD operations, and Holly Street was too. Since then, we've dedicated some additional land at Holly Street to a substation and further stressed that site. And this site really couldn't accommodate the additional staff growth, especially things like parking. We would have to go to structured parking, and the cost of that project would just balloon up. So really, the status quo just got worse with what we've learned over the last, over the last 6 to 8 months. The 10-year split option really is kind of mimicking what we're doing here. So the costs associated with that increase almost commensurately with the what we've discovered here. So there'd be a little higher initial cost to accommodate this growth. And then at the 10-year split, we basically build what we're anticipating, what we're recommending here. So really, the costs track very similarly. But the difference I showed on this slide about doing it later, we would realize some of those additional cost inflationary pressures on that project. So we're very confident that the delta between the projects does not shrink with this option, but maybe even gets greater. It's really the best time to do it.
I want to underscore Dan's point here, because our North Star is always that this is best value for our customers over the long term. So the question that comes up here is, how does this compare against that original analysis that we did? And what we're dealing with is a modest change in the basic assumptions, and how would that have impacted the alternative cases if we were not to go forward with building the new service center. And I think we can safely say that it's equal to or greater than increase in cost that would have occurred for those alternatives if you would have changed the assumptions to be consistent with what we're finding now as we get into the details of the schematic design.
Thanks, Steve. So this leaves us on where are we at in this project and how comfortable we are with what we're bringing forward in terms of this added space. And we're always looking at what risks exist on a project, and are we adequately contingencied? Is contingency the word? No. Do we have adequate contingencies to cover our risks? And so we sat down and looked at, and we keep track of where our risks are, and some of the risks that we're still tracking that have not yet come to fruition and we don't know enough about yet to be able to say what the impacts will be is obviously this additional unknown stakeholder requirements that shrinks as we move through design. Schematic design is we're going to hear the most, and those kind of shrink as you go through the process. Horan Road vacation is something we'll be going with the to the city with in the next several months, and if that we were not able to get the Horan Road vacated, that would impact our site and how we utilize the site. And so that's still an unknown at this time. Shoreline use, we're actually meeting with the city this week to talk about some of the southern areas, and in the shoreline conditional use permit, we think that's actually moving forward in a positive manner. Offsite road improvements, we know what we need to do. We're actually going through the cost estimating at this point, so we have an allowance for that. Construction cost escalation, this is probably our biggest risk, always is on a project where you're out a little bit. We have contingencies for that, but are we adequately covered? We don't know yet. And then building code updates. We think we actually have this one closer to being answered. We're going to go with the new building code. We know we're close enough to when the new building code will be adopted that we're incorporating what the new building code requires, so that we aren't kind of sliding in under the old code and then building something that's somewhat grandfathered in. So we're going to go with the new code. But we don't know exactly what those costs are associated with it. And then we'll have most of those resolved during the design process. And so when we come back to actually execute the construction agreement, most of these should all be known, and we'll know whether it's contributed to the project cost or not. And then ongoing, the things that will take longer, cultural archaeological mitigation, some of those things won't be known until we're out digging on the site. That's always a risk until you're done digging on the site. And then typical construction project risks, and there are contingencies that in place that cover some of that that will be maintained through this process. So these are just to be aware of what the risks that we're still looking at the future.
What would the mitigation of the cultural archaeological mitigation be? That's prime site.
It really depends on what was discovered. We do know that the archaeological site 209, which covers from the water line up into the site, one of our buildings is right on that line, just getting over that line. So if we were to find something that we couldn't mitigate through just simply classifying, curating, and going on with construction, we may have a building that couldn't go where we think it's going to go. And so the impacts could be monetary. They could also be operational, in that we would have to move that function possibly off-site. So there's a monetary piece, and there's also an operational piece to that. So as we move forward, there's really three scenarios to consider here. We could move forward with our current space program. As David said, we meet our needs when we move in. It does have a little bit of room for growth. The thing that concerns us is that we lose flexibility and resiliency in the building for the future, any future changes. We could go through the process and then decide at the end of design. We recommend not doing this because the delay, everything we're doing now, we're investing in that final package. The further we go down this road, the more it takes to unwind that. And so we'd have a substantial delay if we did this later. Or we can add the square footage now put that into the schematic design process before we close schematic design, but it will likely result in a cost variance and a slight schedule delay, although we don't think it's a substantial schedule delay that would affect a move-in. It would probably be within, you know, a 1 month or 2 month delay at this point. And when we were considering these, we kept going back to what were our objectives as we started this project. And the flexibility of the space and resiliency of the space to meet our future needs was a key objective. To make sure that this was a long-term investment. So is this an investment that gets us there and great in 2023, but maybe needs some work in 2027, 2028? And so for the long-term viability of the building, we think the recommendation of the additional square footage is really a good recommendation to make at this point.
So our recommendation is to explore adding approximately 10,000 square feet. As Dan said, that would be roughly adding one more structural bay to the building to the east. We continue through schematic design development, and into construction documents with this approach, and I think we would come back to the board with periodic updates during that time, but then formally revise the project budget prior to entering into a contract with our GCCM for construction, which is expected around summer of next year. So we would like to answer any questions that you might have, and we'd really like to hear any of your thoughts.
Commissioners, questions? Comments?
This is Steve. I appreciate the presentation and am in agreement with the additional 10,000 square feet. The last thing we want to do is build a building based upon current needs with no thought into the future. And I think that leads me into my next question. As we look at the construction of future space, do we make any allotments in the design of the current building that says, you know, maybe in 12 to 20 years, if additional space that's needed to be built for staff, then this is where it would go. Is that built into, you know, where it's kind of a modular thing where you can just attach it and away you go? It's electrical, plumbing, or, you know, the thinking has gone into how to appropriately add that in the future.
Yes, we are thinking through that, and we're not looking for the administration building. We're not looking at extending that building, but we are allocating space on site that we could construct another building in the future, and we'll have utilities clear of that area and think through how we would make those utility connections. And that way, it would have less impact on operations at the time and be more adaptable to our needs at that time. And then within all the operations buildings, we have strategies for minor changes as needed. So we are thinking through a long-term growth strategy.
Okay. Well, that answers my question. That's what I would be pushing for this next 7% increase, planning on that for the future, and then even additional options for the future, I think, is really important for us to do that. Sounds good to me. I'm supportive of the direction that you're looking at here or presenting.
Thank you.
I would echo Commissioner McKenna's comments about, from a commission perspective, the most important thing, one of the most important things we do is try to look far enough down on the horizon to not sell short what we're doing today. And this has a vision attached to it of where we're going. And I think that's really important, keeping that in mind. So I can be very supportive of this.
Thank you.
This is Ann. I have a question. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay. So the initial, the first proposal, or the initial proposal, the current space proposal, if I understand it correctly, so the individual office space has been decreased, but there's more meeting area, more collaborative spaces built in, correct? That was the initial concept.
Yeah, the initial concept would have more collaborative space and more meeting rooms,
right.
And that's what that's actually something that's been stressed as we've added space for staff, is we've had to give up some of those spaces that we initially dedicated.
Right. So I'm just trying to start someplace and then take you where my real question is.
Okay.
So then, with the projection of possibly 70 more employees, or certainly increased number of employees, then that collab, if we didn't do anything different, if we stuck with the current space program, the collaborative space would have been reduced, correct?
That is correct.
To make room. So now then, with the new proposal, which will meet the needs of increased number of employees, is the collaborative space at least back to what it initially was? And the reason I ask that is because it seems that people are more importantly wanting to have more openness, or at least our younger generation coming in as employees want. Okay, that's all. That's great. That's all. It took me a long time to get my question out, but that's what I was looking for. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a curiosity. You mentioned that the additional space would be added on the east end of the facility.
It'd actually be, and we were going to have a picture here, but if you look at the administration building there, and I think I have a cursor. So if you slice it kind of right through this section in the middle of the building, we would add a bay about in this area, would be kind of just east of the lobby. We would add a structural bay. So that would just push everything on that part of the building east about 32 feet. And so the building just gets 32 feet longer. And what enables us to do is to move things around inside the building, slide things, open things up that were getting compressed, rather than just putting it on the end and sliding everything down. It makes sense to put it at that location.
That answers my question.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sorry we didn't have a better example.
No, that's perfect. That.
Okay.
Exactly. Thank you.
I'm going to take one more moment just for the board's benefit, because we did have a conversation about if we have growth in the county, 10,000, 20,000 more people, and we need to provide service to them, then the things in the back need to grow to some extent. I know you guys have thought about that. Would you just take a moment to describe your thinking about how we would address that?
Yeah, we have thought a lot about what growth looks like in our operations space, and the nature of the space just allows for quite a bit more flexibility, because most of the assets are on wheels, and so we can move them and reorganize as needed. We do have a number of different strategies within each building to accommodate some growth for that specific need. For example, the fleet shop is designed so it could add a bay. The warehouse has a strategy for racks going up and getting taller in height. And we have tons of examples like that. So we think that just the nature of the space has more flexibility. Dan is reminding me that in our line truck parking area, we're actually designing so that could have a mezzanine built out over the trucks in the future. And so you can build that space out to whatever need arises. We just don't have those kind of options with the A building like we do in the operations buildings.
Thank you.
That actually sparked a question. What is the height of those buildings in the back?
It varies quite a bit. Actually, each building is a different height. I'm trying to remember what our...
I can get back to you on that.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
They're very tall, high bay, one-story buildings. They're not... I mean, if you look at the video, I'd encourage the commissioners to look at the video online. You can get the perspective of the different heights.
It appears to almost be a two-story, but that's why I was asking the actual...
They height. Do accommodate mezzanine, so it's a high bay that can have either a high... shop type use or a lower shop type use with a mezzanine above it.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think our conclusion from that would be that the board is comfortable with us. It's not a formal decision at this point because we don't have a contract ready to go, but that for planning purposes that we would assume the addition of the additional bay, the additional 10,000 square feet, and that as we bring forward the contract in the summer next year, that would be built into the design.
Just a comment about growth. As I look around the boardroom today, I realize that I'm probably have lived in this county longer than anybody else in the room. And in that time that I've lived here, the population of Chelan County has well more than doubled. And so growth has been a real constant in this county.
And that was our plan all along, was to make sure we weren't building something that wasn't resilient and flexible to accommodate that growth.
I'd like to just take a second and kind of echo what Commissioner Smith said. And it's one of the harder aspects of this job is to try to look into the future with a somewhat foggy crystal ball and prepare the residents of the county and the utility for what might be the future in an unknown world. And we can look back at our forefathers who had the vision to create the hydro projects in the first place. Some might have ridiculed them for the building the hydros. But now as we look back in hindsight, what a marvelous gift it was to the county. So as we sit here today and in other meetings talking about service center and rebuilding the hydros and all the construction that the utility is undertaking, you know, I'd like it to go on the record that we are all trying to the best of our ability to look into that somewhat hazy crystal ball and provide for the next 50 years and beyond, and to do so in a fiduciary manner that we'll take care of those people, that some of which aren't even born yet, and prepare for an unknown future. So I applaud you for considering growth into the future, and I applaud you to bring this forward today so that we can hear your comments, but also make sure that to the best of our ability, we clear that fog out and really do plan for the future. So thank you.
Well, thank you. Yeah.
I'm sure you're keenly aware, as I look at that schematic that you have up there of the new service center, that this is a big moment in the life of this utility.
Absolutely.
We need to do it right.
We said we want this to be the 100-year home. I know we did 50-year analysis, but if we do it right, the PUD will never have to move again.
Right. Great. Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Next up, we want to discuss public power benefits. Felicity Saberhagen will be coming up.
Good morning. Felicity Saberhagen, business manager. Here today to talk about public power benefits. Purpose of this presentation is threefold. First, we want to give the second of two updates that we give annually. Second, to consider allocating funds that are remaining in 2019. At the end of the allocation period, we usually close out funds, and so we have a decision to make regarding the remaining amount. And also planting seeds for 2020. We do have $1.5 million remaining still that has not been allocated. We had an awesome year in 2019. Just wanted to point out a couple of great projects that we had. We were able to launch the supported employment pilot project. The Discovery Center is in flight, and exhibits are being designed as we speak. Day-use parks, we issued over 1,700 day-use passes. And fiber continues expansion with over 500 premises passed this year. If we want to look at the whole entire program, this is even more amazing, too. We have our county coverage right now is at 76% for fiber, and over 3,200 premises have been passed as a result of this program. 8,000 day-use passes have been issued, and we have funded it through 2022. A hydro research institute was established, and we've had added additional contributor in 2019. Our Rocky Reach Museum and Discovery Center was kick-started with this program. We've been able to look at doing fish viewing windows, looking at moving the museum, and then increasing the exhibits that are housed within that. And our jobs and work readiness program, we were able to launch a supported employment program. We have one employee already, and we have a second starting next week. Getting to the decision point, as you can see here, we have $125,000 of the $4 million that was allocated in 2019. To help with understanding where we are with that, in 2020, we also have $1.5 million that has not been allocated yet. We do have three large projects that are under consideration right now. Additions to our water wastewater system and our fiber acceleration program. These two are not ready to bring forward dollar amounts, so we're not requesting that we add any to these at this point in time. But our Rocky Reach Discovery Center, we don't have the final amounts, but we are much further along in terms of the design of this program. And the $125,000 that is available would go a long way to being able to give us some leeway in terms of the choices we make on the exhibits. So our next steps, we do have the option of allocating $125,000 from this program. It is within staff authority to do all of the tasks that would be necessary to do that, but because it is a board program, we would like to make sure that you're in agreement with the recommendation. So just looking around, looking a bit of a head nod, and Ann, I'm not sure how you're going to do that on the phone.
No, I support it.
Wonderful. Thank you. And based on our strategic plan,
Commissioner McKenna is on the phone too.
Commissioner McKenna?
Correct. I'm supportive as well.
Wonderful. Thank you. Based on our strategic plan, program criteria is continuing to be reviewed and revised in 2020. So in spring, we'll be returning to look at the overall program update, which would include evaluating some revised financial funding criteria that's being developed by staff during first quarter. And a decision point for 2020. Do we want to continue with the $4 million, or based on the revised funding criteria, there may be an alternative to change that amount? And also setting the allocation for 2021 based on that new criteria. So I know I was quick. I just want to make sure, trying to keep you guys on track today. I know you guys have a lot of commitments. So are there any questions I can answer for you today?
Commissioners, questions? Looks like a good plan to me.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Felicity.
Thank you.
Good job.
Okay. Next up, we want to give you an update on the Chelan-Manson transmission outreach and alternative selection process. We're pretty much at a decision point here. So I'm going to ask Steve Wickel, Jenna Rahm to come up and tell you about what's going on.
Hi, I'm Jenna Rahm. I'm a customer outreach specialist.
Steve Wickel, transmission engineering manager.
We just wanted to give you guys a brief status update on the transmission fire hardening project up in Chelan. So we were here in mid-October to present on this project. Since then, we've done a little bit of follow-up outreach. We sent out postcards to all of the property owners along the alignment of the transmission line, explaining the stakes that are in the ground. We also sent a letter to about 150 stakeholders that are within about a mile radius of that line describing the 30% design. And then we held a drop-in session at the Chamber of Commerce and also provided this update to the City Council. We only had two attendees at our drop-in, and they were actually there to ask questions about a totally different project, so we didn't receive any feedback at that time. We also got basically the head nod from City Council at that presentation and have received no comments or concerns from the public in all of the outreach that we've done. So based on this feedback, or I guess lack of feedback, we're planning to proceed with the option to rebuild from Chelan Falls Switchyard to the Union Valley Substation, which was considered alternative one. We've got a $5 million budget approved for this, and we're planning after this update to send another letter to that larger group of stakeholders, just letting them know about the preferred alternative moving forward.
So for the anticipated timeline, after we send out the letters to the residents informing them, we'll do design and procurement in 2020 with anticipated construction in 2021. That's the update.
how many miles in this total project?
Approximately 4 miles.
Okay.
This is a big project from us from a cost standpoint. Not an inexpensive program. We've been at this for a long time. You may recall we started with the fire hardening risk assessment. I think that was completed more than 3 years ago. Came out of the last strategic plan. This is the first big project to come out of that. By picking this preferred alternative, we are making an important choice here. Now, of course, the board still has decision points with respect to contracts that will come before it, but this is a critical moment for us in terms of saying, yeah, we're going to go forward with this fire hardening project.
Well, based on the feedback from a few years ago after the fires up there, hopefully this will help keep the cell towers lit. You notice I didn't say keep the lights on.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to also get on the record and really make this clear that when we do some of these projects, there is significant cost associated with the projects. And there's also significant cost with respect to a wildfire and the damage that that causes, not just for our structures, but also for the public and the residents. But let it soak in that this is $1.25 million a mile. That's a lot of money. Thank goodness we're in a position that we're able to do it, and I think it's the right thing to do. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
And this is Steve McKenna. Wanted to really express my appreciation for staff. Just a tremendous effort has gone into communicating with the community on our concern and options and solutions. And I think it makes so much sense that obviously we haven't had a lot of feedback on that, but I think it goes to just reinforce that this is the right thing to do. And we have plenty of options for people to respond. And I think this reinforces that this is a good decision and a good vision for the future, as the commissioners speaking before me have mentioned. But so anyway, I just wanted to express my gratitude to staff. You've worked hard on that, and the plan makes sense. So good job.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you both very much.
Okay, next up we want to provide something that we hope will become a regular part of the board agenda, maybe every quarter, every 6 months. It's an update on what's going on in our Fish and Wildlife program. We've got Lean Underwood, Ian Adams, and Catherine Willard that'll be presenting.
Good morning.
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 So we are very excited to be here today. As Steve mentioned, this is hopefully one of many future more routine updates on what we're doing in Fish and Wildlife. Of course, we find it very exciting, so we want to share that with you. So here with me today is Catherine Willard, our senior fisheries biologist, and Ian Adams, hatchery maintenance operations coordinator. And today we're planning to give you an update on the performance of our new Rock Island passive integrated transponder pit tag antenna project. Ian's going to update us on our resident fish stocking program. And then Catherine will talk about our HCP tributary committee update, the projects that we have funded through that process. And we'll wrap it up with the 2019 adult fish returns. So, in 2018, staff presented a resolution to authorize a contract to install a new pit tag antenna array in the Rock Island Fishway. We installed that in 2019, and we also committed to following up with the board on the effectiveness of that system once it was installed. As you can see, the problem with our original antenna arrays were that they were noisy. And the noise is most often generated by electronic equipment that's located near the pit tag array system. And this is the system that actually detects the fish when they come back, the adult fish that come back through the ladder that have the pit tags in them. As you can see, our noise levels in our original pit tag system were between 50 and 100%, frequently peaking to 100%. What that means is that anything typically greater than about a 60% noise level means that the pit tags that are in the adult fish are not detected. So while we count them through our counting system, we cannot detect them. This has been a problem for years that we've been trying to solve. So what we did was we found a location further down in the ladder, because of course at Rock Island we have three different adult fish ladders. And this was in the right ladder. So we found a location that was further down in the fish ladder away from those noise generating equipment to install a new system. And you can see our new pit tag system, just that portion, the percent noise has ranged from 5 to 55%. So what's most notable is because we were able to put that system lower in the fishway, we actually kept our existing system, and now we use them as a full integrated sort of redundant system. Just makes it more robust. But what you can see is that allowed us to compare the number of fish that were detected at the lower new antenna with the fish that were detected at the upper, older, noisier antenna. And what we found when we did this comparison is that our percent increase in the number of fish that we actually detected increased in all species anywhere from 6 to 23%. So what does that really mean? We use the pit tag detectors at Rock Island to evaluate our adult fish passage survival, which is a metric in the HCP, and to note our adult run timing. So the fact that we've got these increases, we know now that we are actually accounting for those pit tagged fish, will just serve to improve our program effectiveness moving forward. So really a great success story. Any questions about that before I move on?
The thought jumps into my head. Now, this new antenna was installed at Rock Island, right?
That's correct.
So do we have the same kind of issues at Rocky Reach?
We do not.
We do not.
So every facility is unique in where the pit tag detection location is or where the equipment is related to elements in the powerhouse that could generate noise. It just so happens that in our other systems at Rocky Reach and the other two ladders at Rock Island, we don't see that kind of noise being generated.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. As is evident from the talk that Aline just gave, quite frequently when we're talking about fish in the hatchery department, we're usually talking about our anadromous species. And this morning I want to talk about our resident species. And for context, an anadromous fish is one that migrates out to the ocean for a portion of its life cycle, and resident species don't choose to do that. Typically, they choose to live their life in lakes and tributaries. Both our Rocky Reach and Lake Chelan license articles have provisions in them for protection, monitoring, and enhancement of resident programs in Chelan and Douglas County, and the latter being a Lake Chelan requirement, the Douglas County portion. And they specifically state that we're to provide funding for enhancement of recreational fishing opportunities in those locations. Currently, our resident program consists of kokanee, cutthroat, and rainbow trout. In 2019, we released about 215,000 of those little guys in anywhere between the fingerling and the catchable size. And we did so in about 24 different lakes and tributaries, as you can see there on the slide in front of you. So the district's resident trout are reared at both Chelan and East Bank hatcheries. Chelan hatchery right up near the BB Bridge along the Columbia River, and the East Bank hatchery just on the Douglas County side of our Rocky Reach Dam. And both of those sites are operated by Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife operators. And then the state also manages all of the release dates, the fishing dates, the site-specific rules for fishing. The PD is not involved in that portion of the resident fishery at all. And then these programs are very popular for not only our local customer owners, but as the traveling anglers as well. And not only are they popular, but what they are used for in a lot of cases are educational purposes. I'm aware of several programs where there's groups that take kids out to these sites and they're teaching them not only how to fish, but just be respectful of our natural resources. Yes?
I just have a question more for clarification. Each one of the lakes that is on your slide, mm-hmm. So Jameson Lake and Twin Lakes, Fish Lake, those are all lakes that we stock?
They are, yes.
They are. Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Just thank you.
You bet.
That's a very informative slide.
It is.
You please a lot of my friends up the valley. I just have to ask the question, though. How are we connected to Jameson Lake?
It's because of the Lake Chelan license, and it's because of the impacts Rocky Reach Dam has. I'm sorry, I said Lake Chelan. I meant Rocky Reach license. It's because of the impacts in the reservoir behind Rocky Reach Dam.
So Jameson actually feeds in through some...
Do you know history on why the lakes are picked? The state selects the locations.
Jameson's the only one that just sort of left out. Mm-hmm. Why?
Right, way over there in Douglas County.
Yeah, my guess would be that these are our portion of the stocking as part of larger stocking efforts that the state does. And so they sort of apportion our fish as part of that larger effort. So it's just a really popular lake.
Yeah.
And this is just a curiosity mm-hmm. question, but in terms of, you said we stock 200,000 fish.
Yeah, a little over.
Does the state tell us how many fish goes in each lake, or
they make those decisions in conjunction with, there's fish forms, there's a Rocky Reach and Lake Chelan fish form that are made up of various parties that make those decisions, along with the state is a party of those.
Great. Good. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
All right, and I'm going to talk about the tributary committees and our planned species funds. If you recall, the district's habitat conservation plans, or HCPs, for Rocky Reach and Rock Island are adaptive management plan for achieving no net impact, or NNI, for planned species, which includes sockeye, chinook, steelhead, and coho. Meeting NNI is a three-pronged approach, which includes meeting a standard of survival for combined juveniles and adults for the planned species as they pass through Rock Island and Rocky Reach. The second is our habitat compensation programs. And the third, which I'm talking about today, is our planned species funds. Also, we refer to these as tributary funds. These funds are used to implement habitat restoration, improvement, and protection projects that benefit planned species in our project area. So from the tail race of Chief Joe Hatchery down to the tail race of Rock Island. The annual contribution of these funds that the district puts into the TRIB fund account is based on a 2% unavoidable project mortality. And this table here shows what we contributed to the Rocky Reach Fund in 2019 and the Rock Island Fund in 2019 as well. And you'll note that there's more funds that go into the Rock Island Fund because there's more adult returns over Rock Island than Rocky Reach because of the proportion of fish that rear off and go to the Wenatchee. Funding decisions are go through the Tributary Committee, which we meet typically monthly. Representatives on the Tributary Committee consist of signatories of the HCP, and including Chelan PUD has a rep, which is myself. All decisions are consensus-based, and here is a table of projects funded in 2019. This has the project name, the location, what sub-basin it was implemented in, the sponsor, people are the different entities that apply for funds to implement these habitat projects, the total cost, and then what the tributary funds contributed to these habitat projects. excuse me.
Bless you.
Thank you. There's a more detailed description of these projects in your packets because they're all pretty complex, and it gives a good description of what these funds are doing. Different sponsors are able to submit applications for tributary funds throughout the year, but most of the applications coincide in the fall when sponsors are applying for salmon recovery funds through the state. And that application process requires a 15% match. And so often project sponsors use tributary fund dollars to meet their program match. And so that just allows for these salmon recovery dollars for habitat improvement to go further. Any questions on this?
Would it be possible to, you know, I don't know that I've ever seen a list of who is on this committee. I would love to see that. Just I know it's a long list.
But. Oh, of the representatives on the committee?
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry, I did. I just generally went over it, but here it is. It's the Yakima Nation.
Is that the full list?
That is, yep.
Okay. Okay.
Yep. And they, again, are the signatories to the HCP.
Yep. Okay, good. Thank you.
Does everyone on that list receive an equal vote?
Consensus.
Yep. Okay. Yep. Thank it just you. Takes one vote to
throw it off.
Throw it off. Yep.
Yeah. Thank you.
All right. And then I was going to provide an overview of adult fish returns in 2019. With the exception of steelhead, sockeye, and bull trout, fish counts at Rock Island were slightly above counts in 2018. Sockeye counts in 2019 were extremely low. In fact, at Tumwater, we only had about 11,000 adult returns to Tumwater compared to, on average, it's about 44,000. I also provided that the 10-year average, so you can see what it is over a 10-year period, and then the percent of average at Rock Island and to Bonneville. The reason I provided Bonneville was to demonstrate that this decline in returns isn't just localized in the Upper Columbia, but also everywhere in the Pacific Northwest. You might be wondering why we've seen these recent low returns, and it's really a combination of several factors. It's not just one factor. In 2014-15, you might recall, we had really warm water temperatures in the summer when adults were returning, and that affects their spawning success. Another big, probably the biggest contributor is the blob in the ocean. It's that massive warm water that we've seen in 2013, 14, and 15. Luckily, that's dissipated, but that blob will affect food resources for salmon, and so that then they don't survive as well when they're returning back to spawn. And then additionally, we have a predator problem with pinnipeds or sea lions and also birds. We've seen low returns like this in the past. In the 90s, returns were lower actually than what we're seeing now. So hopefully with the dissipation of the blob and a lot of luck, hopefully fish will start to return at higher numbers. So it's kind of a good bad story.
We're actually seeing on a year-over-year basis an increase in the Chinook and the Coho, still not to the 10-year average numbers, but the other species seem to be in decline during that 2018-19 year. Is there a reason for that?
Yeah, so the reason for the recent, it's actually been 2017, 18, and 19, it's been in a decline. And the main reason is in 2014 and 15 when we had that really warm water year when adults returned. And so those fish that were the product of those adult spawners in 2014 and 15, they're returning now. And so that's why we're seeing the decline, because it's combined with the poor ocean conditions and the increased predation.
I see. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I didn't realize lamprey were migratory.
Yes, they are.
I did not realize that.
Yeah, they like to hook on to fish, too, to help themselves migrate.
Beautiful little critters.
Yeah. So can I go back to the lamprey for a minute? This is Steve. So the 10-year average is 3,000, over 3,900. And then so there's some success there. So, and can you talk a little bit about that? And
I will say that this year, or 2019, it was extremely low, but 2 years ago, we had the highest return of lamprey that we've seen since we've been really tracking. And so they tend to fluctuate. Not certain why this year it was a lot lower, but we definitely, 2 years ago, saw a higher return of lamprey.
I just had those numbers turned backwards. I see. Oh, that's interesting. That's a big difference. Huh. Okay, thank you.
Yes. And then we wanted to end with a picture of a cutthroat caught in Lake Chelan from one of our programs. And that's my son.
Good-looking fish.
There it is, healthy-looking fish. Yeah.
Great dinner.
They are good. Yeah, they are really good.
Commissioners, any questions or comments for this team?
Well, this is Steve again. And I have to tell you, I really appreciate the updates every once in a while. I learn a lot from those, and I would just like to see those continue. I look forward to that, and I appreciate the education that I get from you guys. Every time you present, and then every time I talk to you guys, I'm learning more and more and more about this important work. So this is an area that I get a lot of questions from people in the community. There's a lot of interest, and I just appreciate this update.
Well, we appreciate the opportunity to give it, and we're just as eager to come on a more regular basis. So happy to do so.
That's great. Thank you. I have to tell you that I really learned a lot from your presentation today, and one of the things that was most impressive to me is your resident fish stocking. I had no idea that we stocked so many different lakes and ponds throughout both Chelan County and Douglas County that just blows me away. So I really appreciate the information. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I have to say, one of the local fishermen extraordinaire keeps talking about the kokanee, and I never knew where they were coming from. But a lot of sport fish there.
Mm-hmm. Well, great! Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Look forward to your next presentation,
commissioners. Because we have two commissioners that are going to be attending the Columbia River Treaty Town Hall in Richland tonight, I'd like to, since we have some time, get started on the afternoon agenda, if that's okay with you. And one thing I would suggest is that We take care of the consent agenda. I don't anticipate there's anything here that would create public interest or public comment this afternoon.
Well, in that case, I would move approval of the consent agenda.
Do we hear a second?
I second.
So it's been moved and seconded. Is there any discussion on the consent agenda? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
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 It's been approved. The yeas have it.
Great. Thank you. And I'm going to start picking off some afternoon items, if that's okay, just to get some things done. I want to invite John Stoll to come up and just talk about the Christmas Eve hours for this year.
Good morning, Commissioners. John Stoll, Managing Director of Customer Utilities. Just wanted to give you a quick heads up that Christmas Eve, I believe, is Tuesday. So midweek with Christmas on Wednesday. That this is a number of years we've been doing it with the customer service area. We shut down the office about 1 o'clock. I believe it's the fifth year in a row. Kind of follow normal business practices in the Valley, and it's a really good opportunity for the folks on the front line who've been working hard on the CIS project and others to go home and spend some time with their family. So they take PL. So we will still be open and functioning, just the customer service areas will be shut down.
That's great. Good. Thanks, John. Thank appreciate you. That. And if there is any kind of a problem out in the community and one of the residents want to report it, what would they do? Just call?
Yeah, if there's a service issue, they can always call any one of our outage lines or service lines. Good. And so, yeah, we'll always respond to issues.
Perfect. Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
We have one other manager item that I'd like to take care of. You have an email from Mike Coleman that came right at the beginning or maybe even in the middle of this meeting that's an update on fiber premises passed. We've signaled to you that we're behind schedule and not likely to hit the target this year. We're getting close to the end of the year, so we're able to estimate that at this point. And we are pretty substantially behind. We're probably looking at, we were shooting for 1,033 premises. We're thinking we're going to miss the target by just a little under 500 at this point. There's a number of them we think we can catch up on in early January, depending on weather conditions. But we've got some things that are positioned, hopefully, to be able to address this. The fundamental challenge continues to be trying to deal with the changes to National Electric Safety Code and our ability to have make-ready work ready so that we have poles that we can attach to, that we're not creating an increased compliance risk for ourselves. In order to be in compliance with National Electrical Safety Code. We also are engaging in a pretty intense conversation internally about how we can seek to try to make up those premises and hit our original target for 2019, miss the catch up on the ones that we missed, as well as what our target was for 2020. Can we find a way to be able to do that? Not prepared to make any commitments today, just say that that's part of our discussion as we look towards the 2020 performance plan, and it should have an idea for you in January as to our ability to do that. So there's more details in Mike's email. I refer you to that. And happy to come back to this at any point in time if you want to talk about it further.
Steve, I'm aware from speaking with other commissioners throughout the state that the NESC is causing delays and concerns throughout the state with other PUDs and trying to upgrade their systems to meet compliance. So it's not just here at Chelan, it's elsewhere as well. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, thank you for that feedback. I thought what I also might do is just close out a couple of the delegation of action items. We've got a few of them that we accomplished today. We had one that we were going to get back to you on how to manage remotely for communication or RF on AMI. You heard that in today's presentation. We had one to check in with Commissioner Bowles on his view on AMI opt-out policy. I didn't offer that. I should have probably earlier. He indicated that he was comfortable with the direction as I described it coming out of the last board meeting that the other commissioners had agreed to. And what you heard today was our view of that, and you have confirmed that. So I guess I'm feeling pretty comfortable that Commissioner Bowles is feeling like this is headed in a direction that he is comfortable with. We had a an action item for Rebecca to check the 2020 Waputo events, get those added to the commissioner calendars. Those that has been completed. And we have one, you know, we keep a parking lot of action items. We had one that's been on there for almost a year that you heard today, which was the checking in on the fish antenna, the pit tag antenna, to be able to test to see whether that was working or not. So you finally did hear back to that. We have quite a few, actually, in our parking lot. So we try to get back to them as soon as they are ripe for board attention.
I'm just glad that one wasn't mine.
Those are the things that we had. The only other thing that the board might take up this morning would be the election of officers.
Well, and commission items. I mean, in general, I've got one. In addition to election of the officers, I've got one item I'd like to have.
Oh, and commission people. Yeah. Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, those two, both.
Yeah. Speaking of election of officers, I would like to move that for the 2020 year that we elect the following slate of officers for our commission: President Gary Arsenault, Vice President Steve McKenna, and Secretary Ann Congdon.
And I think it would be appropriate, I wrote out the question, I'd like to second that.
So it's been moved and seconded. Is there any discussion? Hearing no discussion, all those in favor of the proposal from Commissioner Smith, please say aye.
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 Aye. Aye. The ayes have it.
And then I did have one other commissioner item. Okay. Last week I had the opportunity to go to the Rewire conference in Seattle. It was an all-day conference. And it was talking about the political landscape, what's going to happen in Olympia on a broad basis. But one of the first sessions that I went to and that I really wanted to comment on was a session I went to, Lessons Learned from the 2019 Elections. And actually, Sean Seaman was in that same session with me. And so we both heard the same thing. And what I found interesting is the panel of four people were all from King County. That was a little bit of an aha moment to start with. And they were talking about the CARTAB initiatives and all the initiatives broad-based, totally from a King County perspective and where things went right and where things went wrong, not looking at the big picture. I give Sean Seaman a lot of credit for posing the question in this briefing, you know, to asking the panelists, how do you view this from the big picture of the entire state, recognizing that we were from Eastern Washington? And the comment that came back immediately, and I believe it was from David Goldstein, who used to be associated with the Stranger newspaper in Seattle. Some of you may be aware of that. The immediate response was, he said, well, the last time I counted, Eastern Washington represented about 18% of the electorate, and that really doesn't matter to us. And that was, I mean, it was just a stunning moment that we are regarded in that light. Their biggest worry was the slippage in Pierce County on the CARTAB initiative. They worried about the three counties, and that was it. So, for your information, and our folks need to be aware of that. We got a lot of work to do. So, anyway, that's my commissioner report. It was a good conference. That, I mean, even that was insightful, very educational.
Just any other commissioner items.
So we're at the point where there are perhaps any other commissioner items out there? Steve or Ann?
I have none.
No?
I apologize for not being there today.
Well, no problem, Steve. You're under the weather. It's actually, I'm glad that you didn't come because I don't want your bug, whatever you have.
You wouldn't want it.
No, I'm sure I don't. So we're at the point where we're looking for additional public comment. I see no public in the audience.
matters of general business as may become before the commission.
We have one. We have one agenda item for.
One agenda item for after lunch. Yes.
Okay.
So we would ask that we return at 1 o'clock to go through the one resolution that regarding the plan of finance.
Yeah. Okay, and then there will be a short executive session after
and a
that.
Short executive session.
All right.
Yes.
So why don't we? It's 10 till. Why don't we take a? As a matter of fact, if everyone's in agreement, why don't we meet back here at 12:50? Would that be all right?
That'll work.
Would that work?
We'll check to make sure that, that we have the right staff here, but I think it will. Yeah, I'm hearing that sounds like it'll work.
Okay, good. Well, then we'll stay nimble, but that those of you on the phone will try to re-adjourn back here at 12:50. So, very good. We are adjourned. Welcome to the December 16, 2019 business session of the Chelan County PUD Commission meeting. I'd like to remind everyone to please silence any electronic devices that you may have with you today. We place great value in public input at our meetings. I don't see any public here today, but we do, and we are recorded meetings, so if you wish to address any item on the agenda, we ask that you come to the microphone. Please state your name and address for the record, and please leave your comments to 3 minutes. So we are moving right into the resolution.
Yeah, just to review for a moment, we have completed the entire agenda with the exception of Resolution 11. And so that is a resolution declaring official intent under U.S. Treasury regulations of Public Utility District Number 1 of Chelan County, Washington, to pay or reimburse certain expenditures from proceeds of indebtedness and providing for certain other matters related thereto. Heather Allen is going to present today, and the board will recall that we have done a presentation on this earlier, but we do have some new information for today as well.
Good afternoon, commissioners. As Steve mentioned, I was here earlier in November and discussed our 2020 plan of finance, some ideas around that. And today is a continuation of that discussion with the first item on our timeline for pursuing some debt optimization actions being a request for board action today to consider a reimbursement resolution. The reimbursement resolution, I'll talk a little bit more about what that does, but it does preserve flexibility for the district to issue tax-exempt bonds at a later date, but begin spending on projects that qualify for tax-exempt financing now, although the resolution does not authorize the issuance of any future bonds. So it's just a placeholder. It's to give the district the ability to issue tax-exempt bonds at a later date, but does not require us to do so. If the board does decide to adopt that reimbursement resolution today, throughout Q1 of 2020, we would continue with our evaluation and discussion of the plan of finance, and a decision point for a go or no-go bond issuance would not occur until probably about March of next year. That will be highly dependent on market conditions. If we still see favorable conditions to the district, we would then come back to the board in April and request action to actually authorize the issuance of refinancing and new bonds. We would do a payoff of higher rate bonds and then likely in May of 2020 issue new bonds at that time. So the action being considered today by the board is a reimbursement resolution. And really, again, that does preserve flexibility for the district. A direct quote from the resolution is that it is solely for the purpose of establishing compliance with the requirements of Treasury regulations. What the district can do is spend on qualified projects now. The resolution has a placeholder of up to $70 million that the district could spend on qualified projects. And we would not be required to issue those tax-exempt bonds for up to about 18 months from now. Our timeline is obviously targeting next year in 2020, but we could certainly wait longer if the markets indicated that we should. Or if for some reason we decided that we wanted to wait longer, we could do that. Gives us a nice window of time to spend up to that $70 million on tax-exempt projects and still reimburse ourselves from those proceeds. While this is overall, the reimbursement resolution, a small part of our proposed 2020 debt optimization strategies, it is an important part that preserves that tax-exempt capacity for the district. If we chose not to adopt the reimbursement resolution today, we certainly could move forward with those projects, but we would not be able to reimburse ourselves from tax-exempt proceeds. Once you've spent on the projects, if you do not have a reimbursement resolution in place, you can't go back and reimburse yourself for that spending from tax-exempt proceeds. This does support the overall 2020 plan of finance, which is expected to improve district results in both the expected and unusual cases for all of our metrics in either a kind of a neutral to positive status. For debt service coverage, we would see some improvement in the years through 2026 and then have less volatility after there. And that's really driven by the savings from debt service costs. I did talk a little bit last time in November when I was here about how the 2020 plan of finance would impact in the expected and unusual cases, but sometimes graphical or pictures helps a little bit. So that was some of the new information that Steve alluded to that we thought would be helpful. One thing I wanted to point out is that the modestly declining debt leverage over time in our expected case actually supports future financial flexibility if an extended unusual case occurs. In this graphic, the solid green line is representative of our expected case scenario if we do enact the plan of finance, the 2020 plan of finance. And the dotted blue line would be representative of the expected case if we do not implement the 2020 plan of finance. In either case, under the expected scenario, the district is expecting that we'll have a gradual reduction in our overall debt leverage ratio and debt outstanding totals over the next 8 to 10 years. And that does include our plans to issue a modest amount of debt over the next few years to finance capital projects. We have regularly scheduled debt service payments that are in excess of the debt we plan to issue in our current forecasts. And in either of those expected case scenarios, we would expect to see a decline of about $100 million in debt over the next 8 years or so. What that does, though, is that if the district ends up in an extended and usual case scenario, it gives us room to issue more debt to finance capital assets. In both the plan of finance, that solid red line scenario, or the non-plan of finance, orange dotted line scenario, we would expect under the extended and usual case scenario to issue slightly more debt than we have for debt service payments over the next about 8 year time frame. And you can see that that still leaves us room under that 35% debt ratio target. However, if we do begin to issue more debt in that unusual case scenario, while we have room under our debt ratio, our debt leverage ratio, where we start to see a little bit more challenge is actually in our debt service coverage. That becomes the area that becomes a little bit more difficult for the district to manage. In the downside, as we borrow more, that means our debt service would likely increase, and that means that our debt service coverage ratio targets are harder to meet. The good news is that even in the unusual case, in both the red and orange lines on here, which would be the 2020 plan of finance or the non-2020 plan of finance, we're still able to meet our targets in the unusual case. It just becomes more challenging to do so. In either of the expected cases, we have lots of room above our targets, which is really a good place to be because that does give us more flexibility. This assumption does not include any actions that aren't currently in the district's adopted strategic plan, the 2020 to 2024 strategic plan. So there are some tools that if we were in this extended and usual case that the board could consider to take action to improve these results. Those include things like decreasing cost growth or holding cost growth down, restructuring bonds if the financial markets are available for us to do so, delaying discretionary capital to the extent we have capital that can be easily delayed, or also looking at incremental rate increases. Those are all options that the board would have in any of these circumstances. One thing we can do today, though, is taking action to reduce and smooth debt service, which the 2020 plan of finance would help support, which would help us maintain those low and stable rates. Any questions about reimbursement resolution or the 2020 plan of finance?
Commissioners, any questions for Heather?
I'd like to add one point if I could. An important part of the newly adopted district strategic plan is addressing financial resilience. And I think what these last two graphs show is that we have improved the resilience, the financial resilience of the organization, or we will if we carry through on the plan of finance that on some of these key metrics that we've been using for a long time around here, including debt service coverage and debt ratio, that we're better off in every year, and or just about every year, and every case, the expected case or the unusual case, by moving forward with the plan of finance. And I think that connection back to the strategic plan is really important here in terms of thinking through the decision as to whether to proceed with the plan as it's proposed.
Commissioners, questions? Heather, I have one. back a few slides on the right there.
Okay.
So the reimbursement resolution would be up for up to $70 million.
Yes.
And how much of that represents new debt, and how much of that is refinancing existing debt?
So the up to $70 million, this would just be associated with new debt. The refinancing does not require any advance approval. That approval would only occur like in April of next year, and that would be approximately $45 million is what we would be looking at for refinance. This new money of up to $70 million, which is in the reimbursement resolution, would be the amount that we could spend up to and still reimburse ourselves. If the district chose to continue to evaluate our plan of finance and would like to issue more than $70 million, we still have that option available to us. The $70 million that this is approving is the amount that we could spend up to before the point we issue the bonds. In the next roughly six-month time frame before we get to bond issuance, this should be substantially more than adequate to cover that time frame. And would, in fact, probably cover us for about that full 18 months in case something came up where we couldn't or didn't choose to issue until a later date. So the idea is really to preserve that capacity to do so under pretty much all circumstances that we can fathom. But we could certainly actually issue more if we chose to do that.
And how was the $70 million arrived at? How that dollar figure?
So right now, the reason we're recommending $70 million is because it keeps us in about a neutral position from our overall debt portfolio standpoint, and we believe it's about what we need to get through to our next planned issuance in the financial forecast, which would be about 2022. It also matches up nicely with that 18-month window of about how much we would likely be spending on tax-exempt capital projects that the district has available to it through about 18 months. There are potentially a few additional projects that if we actually went out about 3 years is the time frame that the IRS regulations allow us to finance capital projects for, that we could issue slightly more than that $70 million and still be within compliance. So we have some room for capacity to issue more. But it's just trying to balance that trade-off of additional costs versus when do we think we're really going to need the funding, where we're forecasting to be in the market next, and trying to create a balance for that. So we believe at this point in time this is about the right place to be, but we'll definitely continue looking at that.
So as a refresher on what's a qualifying tax-exempt expenditure, mm-hmm. As we rehab our hydro facilities, that portion that is attributable to what we use, the rest that we sell out is not a tax exempt?
So the amounts that we sell out, and it's called private use,
okay,
is definitely not
right.
a good use from a tax-exempt capacity standpoint. There are a lot of complicated tax laws that there is some analysis we can do to potentially finance some of our hydro rehabs with tax-exempt money, but it creates some restrictions around what the district's long-term ability is to use the output of those facilities. So right now, we believe we have enough capacity for what we would call general governmental projects, things, especially for us, our distribution service, lines, substations, things that we're going to be using within the county to serve our retail customers.
that are very clean, good use projects. So we're recommending to certainly focus in those areas first, the things that provide the most flexibility for the district long term. There is a point where we may get to as a district that we may finance all of those projects and not have much tax exempt capacity left. And we would certainly evaluate whether it makes sense at that point in time to do a little bit more thorough analysis and consideration of financing some of the hydro rehab type efforts. But it does place some restrictions on the district about what we can do with that output.
What about the service center?
The service center is also being considered as a primarily tax exempt funded project. We're working with our bond counsel, Orrick, Harrington, and Sutcliffe, to ensure that we're doing the right tax analysis around that. But the majority of that facility should qualify for tax-exempt financing, specifically because the majority of the facility is going to be used for things like warehousing and line response, customer services, those kind of uses.
Thank you.
Hey,
Heather, this is Ann.
Go ahead, Ann.
Yeah, thanks. I checked back in about a minute late. Can you, Heather, just give me, this is Heather, right?
Yes, this is Heather.
Yeah, yes. Can you just give me just your quick intro of what you're presenting today? I'm not seeing anything. Is this a manager's item? I'm not seeing it on the agenda as I look online.
So I'm discussing item number 11, the reimbursement resolution. Mm-hmm.
Oh, the resolution. Okay. Let me take a peek here. Gotcha. All right. I just needed to be directed to that. Thank you.
No problem.
I'd like to just take a second and point out for those that might be listening to our recording, the benefits of refinancing. Would you maybe talk about that just a little bit so that those that might listen to our recording can understand the refinancing and why we're doing that?
Sure. So current interest rate environments are significantly lower than they were when these bonds were first issued in the kind of 2009 timeframe. At the point when we issued bonds in 2009, market rates, especially in the 10 to 30 year range of the market, were higher than they are today. And so being able to refinance those bonds in today's interest rate markets allows us to essentially pay less for the same amount of debt outstanding. It's very similar to refinancing a mortgage where you have an opportunity to not borrow anything additional, but make a smaller payment to your lender. We don't always see those conditions, but right now we do. And as long as those conditions hold through next year, it will continue to be an opportunity for the district to achieve those savings over the next 10 to 15 years.
Puts us in the same market as millions of homeowners that want to refinance.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so while some in the county might see us issuing new debt, the fact is it's paying off old debt and we're refinancing that interest rate at a much lower cost to the district.
Yes, so the overall package will allow us to refinance existing bonds, retire high-rate bonds, and issue new bonds for projects that can be financed at a much lower cost.
Right. Wonderful. Well, and I just think that that's wonderful. I think it's something that is a fiscal responsibility that we all carry that burden of, and it's fantastic that you guys put on your thinking cap and you saw this opportunity and you brought it to the attention of the board. So thank you very much for doing that.
Thank you. We really enjoy working on these types of projects.
That being said, I would move approval of resolution number 11.
Is there a second?
I second.
Been moved and seconded. Any discussion? Hearing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
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 I think that's unanimous. Thank you.
And there was five of us on.
That's right.
Yeah.
Thank you, Commissioners. We'll see you in 2020.
Great. Thank you very much, Heather.
Have a great holiday.
Thanks, Kelly.
And Debbie.
And Debbie. Oh, there's Debbie over there. Hi, Debbie. Okay.
With that, Commissioners, we actually have completed our agenda. We're ready to move into executive session.
Okay, so...
I'm sorry. Oh, no. Rebecca is reminding that we should review the board action items just to make sure we've got those right.
Okay.
We have two. The first is
David Lodge will provide the height of the operations buildings at the service center. And the second is a report on why we are stocking Jameson Lake.
Thank you.
Did we miss anything?
I think that was it.
I think so.
Yeah. Okay.
Good. Okay. And how long will we need for executive session?
I think we could probably do it in 20 minutes.
Okay. So we will be going into executive session to discuss with legal counsel, agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation, to which the district or its board is or is likely to become a party, and or legal risks as authorized by RCW. We'll need about 20 minutes. Okay. We are coming out of executive session. It is December 16, 2019. No decisions were made. No votes were taken. Is there any additional business to come before the commission? Hearing none, we will stand adjourned.